I sent out a lot of material that you can kind of browse through. We're not going to go through this material specifically in class, but it sets the stage for some of the things that we're going to discuss. And if you have difficulty accessing that material, the reason that I sent you the URL instead of sending you the material itself is that if I send you the material itself, if I download it and then copy it, turn it around and send it back to you, I get crossways with copyright violation. But all of this material is freely accessible on the internet. You have to access it yourself. So I sent you the URLs. If you have difficulty accessing that material, get in touch with me and I will help you print that off so that you can have it. Most of it is two or three pages long. It's not extensive reading. The longest article that's in here is the one that deals with why were some books left out of the Bible. That's about six or seven pages. And most of the rest are just a couple of pages. So this is material that you can use to kind of make sense out of some of the things that we'll be talking about. I want to be careful as I deal with this material, not to make this into just an academic kind of pursuit. It's fascinating to get off into the weeds about who did this and who did that and why did they do this and the list of the books and the lists of certain passages that may have been called into question. That's all just fascinating reading, and I thank Lenny and the elders for suggesting that I get some of this material together, because it's material that I just really enjoy. But the problem is I can get way off in the weeds, and I don't want to do that. I want to keep this discussion focused on the really practical importance that this has for us as we try to live our lives. So in order to keep myself from getting too far off in the weeds, I'm going to impose a pretty strict limit on how long I'll make the class. I will try to hold this class to 8 weeks. Right now, I have six classes spoken for, and it may be that it's six classes plus tonight. And it may be that I'll have to go over on one or two classes, but I'll try to hold this down to 8 weeks, because I think that will keep me focused on what we really need to be discussing. I said that it was important as we started to think about this to consider what's going on in our culture. Our culture is being attacked on a number of different fronts. And some people, particularly a popular singing artist by the name of Macy, I have no idea who that is, but she has called into question the use of the American flag. And she really calls that into question because she wants to question the institution that it stands for, not so much the flag. But the way that she's going about attacking the institution is to destroy the symbol of the institution. And she has this long discussion about how certain colors on the flag mean certain things. My guess is there's not a single one of us who could tell Well, I know why there are 13 stripes, and I know that the red stripes stand for the blood that was shed to defend the nation. I really don't know anything about, well, I know that there are 50 stars on it. That's mostly because I lived in Alaska, and Alaska is the last star. But I have no idea why there's a field of blue. Well, she goes into this long discussion. I have no idea whether she's right or not. And at the end of the discussion, she says that she needs to design a new flag that's more inclusive, that does not fall prey to the things that the old flag symbolizes. For instance, they want 52 stars on the flag, and they want those 52 stars to represent, I think it's Puerto Rico and the District of Columbia, in addition to the 50 states. And most people don't even know why we have 50 stars on the flag. So putting 52 on there is kind of pointless, except that when you call into question the symbol, you call into question the institution. Well, the symbol, if there's any symbol of the church, if there's any symbol of Christianity, the symbol of Christianity is the Bible as we know it. And that's being attacked on a number of different fronts. And we'll talk about that a little bit tonight. We're going to talk specifically about the Gospel of Judas. But let me just give you an idea of how I'm going to try to organize this. First, we're going to talk about next week the canon and what that means. And as we talk about the canon, you have to remember that there are various types of writings that New Testament Christian, well, people of all time have been familiar with. There's some writing that's good for learning a few things, but you really can't trust it because it's just not accurate in a lot of ways. And one of those, a representative sample of that would be Caesar Scholic Wars. You know, I took 4 years of Latin in high school, and my last year we had to translate the first chapter of Caesar Scholic Wars. And it's nice to kind of get an impression of what life in the Roman army was like. But when he gets to how many people he killed, the numbers are just wildly exaggerated. So you can learn a few things from this literature, but you know better than to rely on it for very much, because it's just way out of there, just far and away an exaggeration. Then there are some other writings that we're familiar with. They're good for reading because they help us. They give us some practical ideas in our language, in our day, about the things that belong to God. And in this category, I would put the Mishnah and the Targum that were written in the Old Testament period by the rabbis. They were kind of like commentaries on the Old Testament. And then there's the writings that have always been regarded as dispositive. When you need to establish doctrine, when you need to establish what a person must do, then you turn to the dispositive writings. And that's what I think we have included in our New Testaments. That's what was included in the Old Testament, by the way, as well. Now, it's important that we maintain a kind of distinction between the kinds of literature that we're looking at, because if you don't, you can allow literature that's just good reading, and it shouldn't be denigrated, to become as important as the dispositive documents, or become as important as the law and what the law said. And the Jews had a really bad habit of doing that with the teachings of the rabbi, and they put them over against the old law. The Catholic Church does that today. They take tradition and they elevate, and tradition is a good thing. We need to understand that there's a lot we can learn from tradition, but they take that and they put it beside the dispositive documents, and they say that the tradition is just as important as the dispositive documents, or the things that the Pope says ex cathedra or from the chair when he issues an encyclical. They view that as important as the documents themselves. So there are different kinds of writings. And if you read what many of the early fathers wrote about different kinds of documents, different kinds of literature, they usually described the different kinds of literature in terms of the setting where it was appropriate to use it. So they would say that some things were appropriate for you to read at home. Some things were appropriate to read as a part of a homily or a discussion. And then there were some things that were appropriate to read in the assembly as setting down what God demanded. And there was one writer who I think had a really good approach to understanding the different kinds of literature. He said, you have to think about it in terms of what you would do with the literature in a dire circumstance. And this happened with the early church. The Romans were coming in and they were confiscating all of the property that belonged to Christians or to churches. And so this writer was talking about, think about what you would give up to confiscation if, as was the case with the early church or during the Nazi occupation of some parts of Germany and Western Europe, they were confiscating documents and they were burning them. They were burning literature. What would you be willing to freely give up to confiscation? It's just, it's interesting reading. It's good stuff. It helps me to get a handle on some things. But there are some documents, not very many, there are some documents that I would refuse to give up to confiscation, even on pain of death. If you said, give me that Bible, I'm going to burn it. Now, I've got tons of Bibles. I might give you one. I might not give you all of them. But if somebody said, give me all of the documents that are in that Bible, I'm going to burn them, would I be willing to say, I will not give those up? They are that important, even on pain of death. And so that might be one way of looking at the different kinds of documents that the New Testament Christians would have been familiar with. Comments or thoughts about that you'd like for me to include in our discussion? Okay. Let me keep going then. Uh-oh, I think I just made Nancy Robidette. Nope, I made Ted Hoggard the co-host. Once we've sort of discussed some of those things, then we'll talk about the formation of the Old Testament canon. And I sent you a document that talks about the different Old Testament publications and what was included in those publications. And if you're familiar with some of the more obscure translations, you're familiar with some translations that include more than the 39 books that we are typically familiar with in the Old Testament. And one of the books that's been called into question quite a bit is the book of Esther, because in the book of Esther, the name of God never appears. It's the only Old Testament book in which the name of God never appears. So it's kind of an interesting book. We'll talk about that a little bit. We'll talk about the New Testament canon and the formation of the 27 books that we're basically familiar with that are included in most of the Bibles that you would buy. And I gave you a bit of historical documentation about how different individuals included different books in their New Testaments. And we'll talk a little bit about what we can discover about why they included the books that they included and why they excluded the books that they excluded. And one of the people that we'll look at is Martin Luther, who famously excluded some books from the New Testament. And we'll talk a little bit about the reasons for him excluding those books. Then we'll take a little bit of time to talk about the non-canonical books. And by that, I mean basically the Apocrypha, the books that for the most part were written from about 400 BC up to the last of those books was probably written about 300 AD. And we'll talk a little bit about those books and a bit of understanding about those books and why most people don't include those in the canon of the New Testament. And then we'll get to the really important part of this class, the real meat of this class, and that's where I really want to land. And the question is, can we trust the Bible as it's been assembled for us and the 27 books, can we be confident as Christians that all of the books that should have been included in that collection were included and no books that shouldn't have been included were excluded? So I think everybody is aware as we begin that the Bible wasn't written as a single volume, that the Bible is a collection of letters and books and prophecies that were written at various times, and they were assembled into larger collections by people that didn't write them. So there's a bit of information about the writing of the New Testament and the dates that are typically assigned to the writing of those books. And we get the dates by trying to identify some of the events that are described in the book and then find the correspondence between those dates and secular recordings of history so that we can figure out when a particular book was written. I think everybody knows that we don't have any of the original manuscripts. They have long been gone, but the whole process of copying those manuscripts was very carefully circumscribed. I hope you realize that for copyists, and these were copies that were made by hand, for copyists, the care that they took was outstanding so that they might get the copy to be the exact representation of what the original was. It was like they were the first human Xerox machine. They counted the letters on a line. They counted the words on a line. They counted the words on the page. They counted the letters on the page. They took great pains when Old Testament copyists, before they would write the Tetragrammaton, YHWH or JHWH, Yahweh, before they would write that, they washed themselves. They washed their pens. After they wrote it, they destroyed the pen that they wrote it with. And they washed themselves. Anytime they made a mistake, if you got to the end of a page and you counted the letters and the number of letters was off, you didn't go back with whiteout and fix it. You destroyed that page and you started all over again. So this whole process of copying the documents, we don't have the original manuscripts, but the process of copying those documents is so precise that we can have a great deal of confidence that what they did was a credible copy of exactly what the original manuscript said. Comments? Okay, let's go on. As I was preparing the material for this class, one of the things that sort of struck me is the extent to which irreligious people are attempting to destroy Christianity by attacking the basic symbol of Christianity, attacking the trustworthiness, the veracity, the uniqueness of the Bible. And the latest attack on the Bible began really in the late 1990s, and it continued until about 2008, and it surrounds the four different books that were found at Nag Hammadi. They were written in Coptic language, not written in the original Greek. They were purported to be copies of what was originally written in the Greek. But these documents appeared in the late 1970s, and linguists and everybody started working on them. Well, one of those books was called the Gospel of Judas. Is anybody familiar with the Gospel of Judas? Have you read anything about it? Remember hearing about it? Well, let me tell you a little bit about this, and I'll tell you, when we get to the end, I'll tell you why I think this is critically important. A fragment of this book was published in English by the National Geographic Society in 2006. It was in the possession of a rather unscrupulous book dealer. This is a man that kind of begged, borrowed, and stole and did a lot of kind of borderline crooked things and maybe some things that were actually illegal to come into the possession of what he perceived to be valuable manuscripts. So the National Geographic Society published a part of a leather-bound book that this guy had in his possession. It's called the Gospel of Judas. And National Public Radio, NPR, did a documentary about this in 2008. Now, this book, this literature that they have found, it is written in Coptic. That's related to the Egyptian language. I'm not real familiar with the Coptic language. And in fact, this is the work on the Coptic language is relatively recent. But this book was written in Coptic, and the book itself that we have in possession, that this man has in his possession, is purportedly the translation of an original that was written in Greek. Now, this book itself has been carbon dated. They looked at the ink. They look at the composition of the ink, the composition of the paper. They do all kinds of things to try to figure out how old a book is, to try to figure out whether it's just a simple forgery. Well, this one apparently is not. This book, the Coptic version of this book, was dated to about 220 AD, plus or minus 60 years, or excuse me, 280 AD, plus or minus about 60 years. So that would have meant that this is a very early book. The Greek of this book was probably in existence somewhere around 130 to 170. And they base some of that on textual analysis. They look at borrowed language. They look at words and when the words were introduced and that kind of thing. It was written by Gnostic Christians. Now, prior to finding this book, prior to finding the Gospel of Judas, we didn't know very much about the Gnostics. We're learning more and more about the Gnostics as we continue to do research on this book. But this book is really fragmentary. It exists in about 1,000 tattered pieces of what is thought to be 31 original pages that were written on both sides. So 31 leaves would have had about 16 chapters, but out of all of those pages, only about 13 survive. And what survives is sometimes just a single little word on a fragment, and sometimes it's maybe a couple of sentences. And in a couple of cases, it's an entire page. But these books deteriorated. You can imagine the book is pretty old. It deteriorated. It was in the control of a rather unscrupulous book dealer. And the feeling is that he may have just ripped pages out of this book and sold single pages to the highest bidder. Because after this documentary aired in 2008, a couple of pages surfaced that people said they had bought from this dealer. So it's kind of like the flag that flew over the Stars and Stripes that was flying over Fort Sumter. Has holes in it, and it also has places in it where unscrupulous people just cut out parts of it and because they wanted a piece of that flag. Well, people just cut off pages out of this book. So the book is a series of conversations between Jesus and Judas, but it's written from Judas' perspective. And this book tries to present the betrayal in the garden as something that Jesus requested that Judas do. And a lot of that stems from the way that the Gnostics believe. Well, the Gnostics believed that there was God who was there in creation, that he created a certain race of beings called angels, that those angels created Adam. And then because the Adam that they created got confused about who they were supposed to worship, Jesus had to be sent from the Creator God to get them to not pay attention to the angels, but to pay attention to God. Well, it's all kind of Gnosticism, and it's not very well defined. It's not well defined even in my own mind. But this book says Judas was the only one who really understood that the rest of the disciples, they missed out on the true gospel. And Jesus only taught it to Judas because he's described as the only follower of Jesus who belonged to what he called the holy generation. Everybody else was mistaken. You needed to have Judas' understanding of what went on in the garden and the betrayal and the subsequent crucifixion of Jesus, because he's the only one that has the right picture of what was going on. Now, we do know that the early Christians were aware of a book called the Gospel of Judas. In fact, Irenaeus writes about it in his refutation of Gnosticism. He doesn't write about it in a flattering way, but he does mention the fact that the book exists. So the early Christians knew about it, but Irenaeus says, well, he describes the text as a fictitious history. That's the words that he uses. Now, there's some question about whether he's actually talking about this book or whether there was some other book that was called the Gospel of Judas, but we can at least say that there's some evidence that the early Christians were aware of this book, the Gospel of Judas, and that they chose to reject it, that they did not include it in that set of literature that was considered dispositive. They didn't even include it in that set of literature that was considered to be good to read. In fact, they didn't even include it in that set of literature that they could learn something from. They just, for the most part, rejected this out of hand. So, all of that's the case. Why is this important? Well, there's a conspiracy theory around this book. How many of you have seen John Brown's movie? The name of the movie escapes me. Oh, good grief. I didn't write the name of the movie down because it's about the Holy Grail and the search for the Holy Grail. And it was,
Coping Code.
I'm sorry, what?
The Da Vinci Code.
Yes, the Da Vinci Code. Thank you. Oh, my goodness. I never thought I'd forget that, and I didn't even write it down, and I should have. Well, that Da Vinci Code is kind of representative of the conspiracy theory that has grown up around this book called The Gospel of Judas. Remember, the basic, most fundamental assumption of the Da Vinci Code is that the Catholic Church knows about information that they're not making available to people. In fact, they've hidden it away. And it's such explosive information that if the regular people knew about this information, it would destroy the church. And somebody's about to discover the real true information, and whether or not that ought to be made available to everybody, of course, that's what you have to talk about in the Da Vinci Code. Well, the guy that has this book now is named Mario Roberti. He's the president of something called the Maecenas Foundation. In fact, he's the only person who is on the board of directors of the Maecenas Foundation. So this is a foundation that's controlled by this one guy, Roberti. And he suggested that even though there's only one copy of this book, clearly the Vatican has another copy that they're keeping locked away in the Vatican Library. They bought up all the copies, and they're not ever going to let this book see the light of day because it's so explosive. You know, he argues that Gnosticism is the way that it ought to be, but Gnosticism lost out to the dominant theory, and the Catholic Church has a vested interest in maintaining the dominant theory. So the church, the Catholic Church, decided for political reasons to include the Gospel of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John in the Bible, but other Gospels were banned. The Gospel of Judas, the Gospel of Mary, other Gospels were banned. Now, this is what he says, and this is the way conspiracy theories grow. This is the way that they're built. And this is kind of the reason that you can't put a conspiracy theory to rest. He said this: it's highly logical that the Catholic Church would have kept a copy of all of the forbidden gospels. Sadly, the Vatican does not want to clarify further. Their policy has been the same for years. No further comment. But importantly, this guy Roberti never provides any evidence, any real evidence, any hard facts to show that the Vatican has copies of this book squirreled away in the basement of the Vatican Library. The Vatican does have a massive library, and it probably includes a lot of things that people have never seen. In fact, only about half of the Vatican Library has been cataloged. And if it's cataloged, it's available to researchers. You can request access to this material. Much of it's available online. About half of the Vatican Library has never been cataloged. And you can't request it unless you know the title of the thing that you're requesting, and then they'll look for it. But you don't know what titles are there. And so you don't know what to request. It's kind of this circular argument. And Roberti takes advantage of that circular argument, and he says, of course the Catholic Church has a copy of this. They have the original Greek. And the reason that we can't find any other copies is because the Catholic Church bought them all up to keep people from seeing them. Now, I do know that that kind of thing happens. I had at one time in my possession a book by Rutherford called of Jehovah's Witness fame called Millions Now Living Will Never Die. The Jehovah's Witnesses found out that I had a copy of that book because I had a class with a Jehovah's Witness, and I mentioned a copy of that book, and in fact showed it to him, And the Jehovah's Witnesses offered me a fabulous amount of money to buy that book back from me. They want to bury all the copies of that book. I did not sell it to them. In fact, I managed to lose it. In the course of moving, I lost a box of books, and that book was in that box. Now, there are sufficient numbers of copies of that book out there that people know that it exists. It's like the Mormon Church published the 100th anniversary or 50th anniversary of the Book of Mormon, I think it was. Well, it turned out to be a huge embarrassment because it details all the changes between the original Book of Mormon and the Book of Mormon as it exists today. They do their best to buy all of those commemorative copies of the Book of Mormon that you could get for free back because they don't want them to circulate. So there are these conspiracies that happen, and they happen frequently enough that James Brown can write the Da Vinci Code. He can make it very believable, but you can't. There's just no way to disprove it. Why is that important? Well, I have a very good friend who's a preacher, who very smart guy, Ed Sanderson. And Ed said his experience is, and take this for what it's worth, his experience is that people get their biblical knowledge from three sources. One is what they actually read in the Bible, but he says most people have never read the Bible cover to cover. Now I'll let you evaluate that for yourself. The second source is what they remember learning when they were in kids' classes at church. And the third source is what they learned from Cecil B. DeMille in the Ten Commandments. Everybody knows that when Moses received the tablets carved by the hand of God, the way that God did that is Moses held up the stone like this, and this finger of fire came flying around the mountain and hit the stone, and it appeared there in the stone. And that's the way that most people, if you talk to most people, they think that it happened that way. Most people, and there are numerous studies that will indicate this, most people ignore facts in favor of what they learned from entertainment. And that's dangerous because NPR and CNN have done different exposés. In fact, CNN did a TV series that you may be familiar with it. It's called, the series was called Finding Jesus, Faith Forgery or Faith Factor Forgery, excuse me. The third episode of that TV series on CNN originally aired on March the 15th, 2015. And that episode, the third episode, centered mainly around the Gospel of Judas. That's had the impact of making people question the veracity of the Bible that most of us own in our house with 27 books in the New Testament. So, my whole purpose in this study is to give you a reason to know that the Bible as you hold it in your hand is an accurate reflection of the books that God intended to be there.